Heather, one of the services librarians at Heartland's Crow Main Library. And today I'm joined by Shelby in our community relations department, Eric, one of our adult services librarians, and Kelsey, our teen services librarian. And today we are back to talk about scary stories to tell in the dark. And I know that I said that we were done, but we all decided to watch the movie and make a special bonus episode for you about our movie thoughts. So I guess my first question for everybody is, what were your expectations going into the movie?
I never heard any reviews of this movie when it came out, so my expectations were not high. I think it really didn't make much of a splash.
Which is unfortunate, because this is such a cool book. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that that's what I thought of the movie, but you're right. It wasn't, as far as I remember, it wasn't super popular. I remember a handful of people talking about it, but I don't remember it being super famous and popular after coming out.
I had already seen this. Sometime during the pandemic, I forget if it was last year or 2 years ago, but it made such little impression on me that I didn't remember it. And I remember being really excited when I heard that they were making it in like 2019. So.
Yeah, I was really excited when I heard it was coming out. And then I'm such a baby that I never saw it. And so 2 days ago, I decided to go for it because I've been watching more spooky movies since 2019. And I knew that it didn't, you know, follow the book exactly. And I also knew, I think because Eric, you told me this, that it's, I think I remember you saying something like, it's a fine enough movie as long as you're not expecting it to totally hold up to the book.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else had said, probably Heather, that the putting the illustrations into the movie and animating that was done really well. So those are the only two things I knew, is that it doesn't exactly follow the book and that you shouldn't expect it to, and that the animation was pretty darn cool. And that, I mean, maybe I'm biased because that was my first impression going into the movie, but that was kind of my impression walking away too, was that it's really cool looking and fun. And also it's about Shelby level spooky. So it was and Halloween-y and fun, but not actually scary. And so I really liked it, but it wasn't like the best horror movie I've ever seen.
I think it was very Nickelodeon tier.
Yes.
As far as the acting, especially. I think that was the thing I had the biggest problem with. And I don't even think I can blame the actors for that, because a lot of the dialogue was really awkwardly written and they just had to kind of do what they could with it.
Nickelodeon WB-esque.
Yeah, like the only thing I would say that would distinguish it from a Nickelodeon one was that they swore. And there was a racial epithet as the warning put at what that was used as well. But otherwise, I know that one of the weirdest things was like, they didn't like to say dead with people. They would say they're gone. And we're like, is this like a kid's movie where they can't say die or dead? No, because they cuss. So why can't they say dead? That was really weird and awkward. I don't know if anybody else noticed that.
Yeah, it was like the movie didn't really know what audience it really wanted to cater to. Mm-hmm. Kind of like tried to be for kids, but also then like throw in adult edginess or whatever. And I think it kind of definitely suffered by not just committing to, are we going to do like this R-rated thing? Are we going to stick with a PG or a PG? I don't even know what this is actually rated, but they like definitely kind of shifted around a lot.
Yeah, it was super weird. I remember it being very awkward because, again, if it weren't for those couple of phrases, I would say that this was like a late tween, early teen movie if it wasn't for that.
Right.
But some of the language was definitely like, yeah, you won't see that on Nickelodeon. The one thing that I distinctly remember coming out of nowhere was they were tying in the Mitai Doti Walker story. And when the head comes down the chimney, the sheriff looks at it. And he just says, you've got to be shitting me.
Yeah.
Are you shitting me right now? And me and my fiance are watching it together and we just laughed because then he just shoots it. And obviously that doesn't work because that would be too easy. But like, we just started laughing so hard because it seemed like so out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
Like there's that one. And then they say like, damn it a couple of times, but it seems like it comes out of nowhere.
Yeah. And I think too, with like the gone throughout the movie, we'll talk about the end in a little while, but I kind of almost felt like it was kind of a Stranger Things, like maybe they are just gone, like they're in the upside down kind of thing and they might be refound, but we don't know if they were dead yet, even though like a lot of them got dragged and it looked as if that was the case. And I know one of them, didn't they say like she ended up in an asylum or something like that?
Yeah. But then they show her at the end. Yeah. Also, that was one thing that made me laugh too, is like 24 hours after she has her scary story experience, the policeman's like, she's going to an insane asylum and she's going to be there forever. The rest of her life. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, the rest of her life, it's been 24 hours, man. Give her at
she's
least
like
24
17
hours
or whatever.
To get over that nonsense. Yeah. Like, what do you mean the rest of her life? Of course she's panicking. It hasn't even been a full day since this happened.
She had like thousands of spiders burst out of her face. Give her a day.
Yeah, exactly. Like, give her a day. Don't be all like, she's unrecoverable. She hasn't gotten it together in the 24 hours after that happened. And I was kind of glad to see her at the very like epilogue of the movie, just in the back of the car with the other girl with like a scar on her face. I almost didn't recognize her. She looked super different with like her hair down and her scar on her face. But like, yeah, I'm glad that they did that because I was like, geez, Mr. Sheriff, you're being awful hard on this teenage girl.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they were like, with the Gone thing, it seemed like they were trying to set up their own cinematic universe, like the Scariverse or something. Because that's how the movie ends, not, I guess, to get way far ahead before we do our recap, is them in the car, like, and the voiceover, I know that they're out there somewhere and the key is in this book. So they're like going on a quest. I don't know, maybe there's some sequels in the works.
Yeah, it definitely looks like they were trying to set up for a sequel. With how well it did, I say that in quotation marks, I'm not sure if they'll actually get it, but it definitely looks like they were trying to set up for it.
I really hope that there's a sequel. I'll say that right now.
Me too.
I would watch it. But I would watch the sequel.
Oh, heck yes. I'm already planning to rewatch this one again.
Yeah. And this might be something to talk about at the end, like our overall impressions or whatever. But I thought this was a great movie to like play in the background at a Halloween party or whatever, because a lot of it in the beginning, the first chunk of the movie takes place on Halloween night, so it's like super vibey and the music fun, and it was really fun. And then like throughout the movie you get into those really spooky parts and that was cool. So anyways, I really liked it.
Yeah, same. And just thinking about the target audience, like just with some of the things that Kelsey was pointing out, I'm almost wondering if it was like the first readers of this book too, because like the millennial humor, like we were totally laughing, and of course we're in like Gen X and Gen Z, they'd probably be laughing about that kind of stuff too. So I wonder if we actually were the target audience, or if it was just like a general, maybe it is targeted toward like modern kids and that sort of thing. But yeah, that the you're shitting me apart totally made me laugh too.
Laugh so hard.
You gotta be shitting me.
Yeah. Like I laughed so hard. We had to pause it. Like we were dying.
Yep.
And again, like if that was supposed to be scary, it wasn't, but it was hilarious.
And I feel like that kind of keeps in line with the vibe of the book too, because like some stuff was horrifying, but there are also bits of humor like mixed into it as well. So
I did kind of like the overarching story they came up with to try and tie in this anthology. If it's all right, if I bring in that a little bit. Plus,
of course it is.
All right, neat. So the story they decided to do to unite all of the different little tales, because it's difficult when you're adapting an anthology to, okay, how am I going to make this one story instead of a bunch of little ones? So they had a house in their town that was owned by rich people who had, I think it was a paper mill. Did they have a paper mill?
That sounds right.
I think that's right. Yeah.
I think they had a paper mill, and they had a daughter called Sarah, who they thought that something was wrong with her. So they had her like locked in a secret basement bedroom thing. And her name was Sarah. And they said that the local kids would go and they'd knock on the wall outside of the house that would lead to her door. And they'd ask Sarah Bellows to tell them a story. And so she would sit there and she would tell them spooky stories. And then some kids started disappearing and they blamed Sarah and her spooky stories. And then that Sarah died. She was supposed to have killed herself or hung herself with her hair in the mansion. And the kids go into this mansion on Halloween and find Sarah Bellows' storybook. And so that's kind of how they make it. They relate all of the stories. They have the book read you to see what you're afraid of. And then it plays out a scary story for each person to make them disappear. And I thought that was a fun way to tie it together. Mm-hmm. I think that was one of the good writing decisions.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sarah Bellows also to me had like a total Bloody Mary kind of vibe where you have to like do certain things in order to call her in. So just like the connections to that as well. I was like, ooh, this is creepy because the Bloody Mary thing used to totally freak me out as a kid. So it was like playing on that fear.
I really like that. Yeah, it had a really classic feel. And like, while that story wasn't in Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, it definitely fits in with it, you know?
Yeah.
And I liked the idea of like the main girl also liked writing scary stories, being the weird girl who writes scary stories. And that was me as a kid, so.
Same. Yeah, all right. Are you guys ready for the recap?
I'm ready. Totally ready.
Awesome, because as normal, as usual, I took 5,000 pages of notes because I have a terrible memory. Yay. So
we'll do this.
Yes, awesome. And I feel like I should read them verbatim because these are like my initial thoughts as I'm watching too. So we open, OMG, worms crawl in, the worms crawl out was the instrumental music in the background. I loved that. I was already like super excited. I was like, yes, it's gonna be great. So we open with a child narrator, and they tell us that this is going to be the last year of their childhood. So we know that dark things are afoot already. And the story takes place in 1968 in Millvale, Pennsylvania. And the opening scene is a girl and her dad. And she'd rather just stay in, but her dad is like, no, you have to go out. It's Halloween. Like, you have to go and have fun with your friends. And then another song starts playing, which is Season of the Witch. Like, the music for this whole thing was just like totally on point. I like want to own the soundtrack to this if they have one, because it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there were punk kids throwing bottles at a scarecrow.
I'm sure that won't be important later.
Yeah. It's almost like maybe our scarecrow follows us.
The second that I saw that scarecrow, I was like, no, no, hate it.
Yep.
They did a good job translating it. They really did.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What did you like think? Did you feel like it was really similar to the drawing? Because I felt like it was pretty similar.
I thought they did a great job. Really well. With all of the like monster drawing translations, I think they did phenomenal. I think that's one of the best things about the film was watching those drawings come to life and move.
Yeah, that was absolutely, for me, the most fun part was when you would either see the title of the next story written across the top of the notebook, or you would just like, it would start showing some kind of creepy monster and you're just thinking like, oh, that's from the second book with such and such story. And like, oh, that's the big toe and whatever. So we'll get to them. But I thought it was really fun to watch my nightmare fuel come to life.
Absolutely. I felt the same way. I was like just getting so like geeked at this part. I'm like, this is going to be awesome. I love this. So then we cut to a scene where some punk kids are throwing bottles at the scarecrow. That's not gonna end well. Mm-mm. There's also some casual racism. And we had an old tech alert, walkie-talkies, which I guess are new tech too, but it's like older, like 1960s tech stuff. So that was really fun as well.
I got some wannabe Stranger Things vibes with the walkie-talkies.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. Yeah, this movie took place in the 70s or 80s, doesn't it?
I think it was 1968.
Yeah. Oh, really? The late 60s. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm.
To be fair, it's very easy to not place that because I don't think they did much to engage with that, in all honesty.
I'm not sure why they really chose to set it there because it just seemed like not it made everything more complicated. Like, in terms of just like logistically getting all these cars on the road that are period cars for a thing that didn't seem to be important at all.
Yeah, it really did not engage with its time period. Like the closest it did is they talked about the draft and the Vietnam War a little bit. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't know, it really didn't seem that important. I feel like they could have done that differently.
Yeah, I feel like this could have taken place at any time period.
Yeah, I really just wondered if they were going for the nostalgia factor of setting it in retro because it had been popular.
Yeah.
And that they were trying to kind of capitalize on that.
Well, and then it would have made sense to set it in the 80s because the book was written in 1981. So
yeah, that was
maybe that's why I immediately was thinking 80s. I'm not sure. Or maybe the big walkie-talkies. I don't know.
Other than like the one blonde girl's hairstyles. But then she was in a play of Bye Bye Birdie, so she could have done those hairstyles anyway. Mm-hmm. Like, there was almost no, like, 60s-ness to it for me, honestly.
Yeah.
Well, now that I'm thinking about it, too, maybe it was, like, the story happened in the 60s, but then it didn't get, like, published until the 80s. Maybe that's what they were going for. So it's also why I'm hoping for more films.
Mm-hmm.
That would be awesome. All right, so we see a bunch of costumed kids. We've got some clown costumes. And this part made me laugh because there was a kid who wanted to be Spider-Man, but his mom made a spider costume. So he was like really mad and she tells him to be happy the Lord provided.
That part got me so much. He's like, Mom, I wanted to be Spider-Man, not the Spider-Man. And she's just looking him up and down, just... Well, be thankful that the Lord provided.
Oh my gosh. And his friends roast him for it too. They're like, if you're a spider guy, shouldn't you have eight arms, but you have like four in your legs is like six. And he's just like, I don't know. Wanted to be Spider-Man.
The nostalgia of your mom making your costume and you wanting it to be something totally different.
Yep.
I know. And that mom did a great job. She should like give herself some credit.
I know. Thank God for moms. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm wondering too, if in like 1968, like if did people buy costumes at the store like in the 60s? Because I guess I just always assumed they were homemade.
I bet most of them were.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely not to the extent that they're readily purchasable today.
Mm. Yeah.
I would imagine.
So anyways.
any hoozle. So we flash back to the girl who has decided, you know, I am going to go out for Halloween. She dresses up as a witch, foreshadowing. And she's got like moles and there's a red slice on her neck too, which is interesting. And then we cut to another scene where there are boys throwing a flaming turd into the police car. Gave me total Billy Madison vibes too.
I loved the part before that when they were on the phone and the kid was clearly in the bathroom and he had like a fishnet thing, like that you would use in your home aquarium to like get fish out or just clean it. Yeah. And I'm like, what is he doing with that thing? And then like, you know, a scene later, you're like, oh no, gross.
Yeah, when he's trying to like fish something out of the toilet with a little net and you're like looking like, what is he doing? And you're not totally sure what he's doing. And
oh, I was sure.
Door bangs open and the mom comes in and he's like, he like whips around and he's like, a little privacy, please.
His sister rightfully gives him crap for that because like
gives him crap for that.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Pun. Love that. So obviously the bullies see the kids. So the kids end up running into the woods, and then they run into a drive-in movie. And then the kids hide from the other bully kids inside of the car of the person that was the victim of the casual racism in the beginning. We don't know his name yet. It hasn't been revealed yet. And actually, I can't remember it right now either. So
Ramon.
Like I said, this is why I take 15,000 notes, because I can't remember anything. Some more racism happens. I literally just wrote more racism.
I like how they just get in some random person's car to hide.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, this is fine.
He looks like a friendly person. I'm just going to get in this random car.
Yeah.
It's the 60s, baby.
Yeah, I want to know like how the bullies actually finds them, because of course they do. Like, how did you find them in the dark, like in this car sitting with this dude? I don't get it. I got questions. But anyway, the kid saves them from the bullies. And then Stella, which is the girl's name, invites him to see a haunted house. And then it's the Bellows house. And they start talking about the legend of Sarah. And then they stumble on a room with a light on and an old woman. And then someone else opens the door and the room is dark and empty again.
Okay. Do we ever hear about that ever again? The woman with the poodle or whatever?
She's back at the end of the movie when, I mean, not to jump too far ahead, but she does come back at the end of the movie.
Does it, and we can get to this later, but does it make sense? Because maybe I was just too tired by the end of the movie, but I just remember like never understanding what was with the lady and the dog. Do we get anything out of that later?
Not really.
Okay. I was wondering like, is this one of the stories and I missed it? What is this supposed to be? So I guess we'll talk about it later and see if it does wrap anything up. But if it does, I did not catch it.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's who Sarah like would have been if she hadn't died. I don't know.
Sure. Maybe.
We'll get go to with it that. Then we start hearing our earworm. The worms crawl in medley. And then the kids stumble on Sarah's book of scary stories. And this is where things really start to heat up. So somehow the bully finds them again. I don't know how the bully keeps like finding them. And he locks them in the cellar. And then Stella, the girl, says, "Sarah Bellows, tell me a story out loud." And then they end up leaving the house. I think, oh yeah, that's the whole crew. They get out of the cellar.
And ghost unlocked the door.
Yeah.
And we don't know why at this point.
Mm-hmm, it just is. And they find that the car has been vandalized. So Stella invites Mo. Is his name Mo? Why did I write Mo? I don't
know. Ramon.
Ramon.
Close enough.
Invites Ramon over.
Did I write Mo? It's in there. Yeah.
Who's Mo? I don't remember a Mo. And then Stella still has Sarah's book and she starts flipping through and running her finger on a title. And that title is Harold. And the really creepy thing is the ink is still wet. Was this in one of the later books, the Harold story? Was it?
It's in either book 2 or 3. And I understood before I watched the movie that some of these monsters would come from books other than just book 1. So I went ahead and read the other 2 and then watched this. So Harold, do we want a recap of the story, Harold?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. So it's about 2, I think, cattle ranchers, and they do the thing where you like seasonally relocate your cattle so that they get, you know, the fresh whatever. So they're like walking their cattle and they get them up to this little like mountainous area, I think, up on this hill. There's a little cabin, and so they chill up there with their cattle for a few months or whatever, a few weeks, and they sleep in the cabin. So while they're up there, it's just these two guys alone. They're kind of bored. So they make this scarecrow out of some old clothes and stuff. They make their own scarecrow to, you know, keep predators away from the cattle and stuff, and also just for their own entertainment. And that's all fine and good. But then they kind of start picking on Harold the Scarecrow. They would bring him in at night. They would move him from the cornfield or whatever and bring him in at night so that he wouldn't get ruined by the rain and stuff. But when they brought him inside, they would shove food into his face. And like, they started like beating him sometimes. And like when they were in bad moods, they would just yell at Harold. And so it got really dark, this story. Mm-hmm. And then they think that they hear Harold groan, and they're just kind of like, oh, that was weird, but whatever. And they just leave it alone. And then I think it's the next night or a little later, Harold the Scarecrow gets up in the cabin, like stands up and just walks outside. And they're like, okay. And Harold, they suspect that he's alive, and it's really creepy. I will tell you that Harold of all three books is one of the creepiest stories. So to see it in the movie, I was pumped. Anyways, it was really creepy. And they start getting scared of him. So the two men decide to take their cattle and, you know, migrate down the hill and just like leave Harold up there. So they start moving. And then one of the men has forgotten something. I don't remember what it was. It was like a water canteen or something like that. So he's like, okay, I'll go back up there and get whatever it was that we left up there. I'll meet you back down here. You keep going. And so they separate, and the one man goes back up to the cabin, and the other keeps going with the cattle or whatever down the hill. And I think the story ends something like the man going down, his friend hasn't returned to him yet. So he looks back up towards the cabin, and he doesn't see his friend, but he sees Harold, and he's stretching out like a fresh pelt of some kind out of
Oh no.
Yeah. So you take that to understand that the friend has been like skinned and murdered.
It's gruesome.
That you read Harold, it's horrific, and I loved it. But anyways, so for Harold to come into the story, I was really excited and terrified.
You know, and I put in my notes too, like with Harold, you know how we in the pictures, like in the book, we were commenting on like, it seemed like seaweed or something. I wonder if it was like actually hay or straw, because like now that we have that context.
Yeah.
That's so scary. And it actually sounds like then the movie matched that pretty well, because we flash to Tommy the bully, and his story is being written. So we find out that like the story just keeps writing itself. It's pretty cool. So his mom has him take some eggs to the neighbor, and he says he's always hated the Scarecrow Harold. So it cuts through the cornfields, and then the Scarecrow moves as he gets lost in this corn maze. This will also haunt my dreams, by the way. Like,
hated it. I've been doing a lot of work in cornfields the past month or so, and I hate it now.
Thank you, movie, for giving us this gift. And then Harold slashes Tommy with a knife, and then straw begins to grow out of Tommy, turning him into a scarecrow, which is also horrifying. But I feel like it also kind of echoes back to Stella's, like the slash she painted on her neck too. So maybe the witch she was, maybe she was actually Sarah, and she just didn't even realize.
Tommy deserved it.
Yeah, not gonna lie, he did. So then the cops question Ramon about Tommy's disappearance and says even more racist stuff to him. And then Stella ends up finally showing the boys the book. And she tells them that the story just appeared while she was like looking at it. It was just writing itself. Then Stella is just telling Ramon a little bit more about the book, and they walk into the cornfield together to see if they can find Tommy. And they do, because his scarecrow is there, but obviously I don't think they knew it was Tommy, did they? They just thought it was like,
they start kind of like,
see his clothes on it, and they're like, this is Tommy is wearing this jacket.
Mm-hmm. That's terrifying.
They start to suspect. They're kind of like,
yeah, they're suspicious.
Sleep deprived, or did Tommy turn into a scarecrow?
Mm-hmm. Ugh, that's terrifying. All right. Did I skip ahead? No, I did not. So Stella goes back to the house to put the book back. And then Ramon gets back to Stella's house and picks up Sarah's book, which was just sitting on Stella's bookshelf. So that's terrifying as well, because she went to put the book back and oh, there it is in her room again. And then another story begins writing itself, and it is the big toe.
One that we all know and love.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And this one ends up affecting her friend Augie. So Augie finds some stew in the fridge, and he said he knows this story because his dad told it to him as a kid. Stella ends up doing the storytelling as the story is writing itself, and then Augie eats the stew and finds the big toe.
Gross.
So gross. This I think was my favorite story interpretation in there. I think they did a really good job. Like so, when you saw the stew pot that just appeared in there, me and Donovan were just like,
This makes me wonder, like, were they doing almost a Freddy Krueger thing where, you know, like Freddy Krueger was torturing the kids of the people who killed him? Do you think their parents were the ones who were like listening to her stories, like the kids who were knocking on Sarah's wall to get the stories?
I don't know.
I thought that the kids that knocked on the wall were the ones that
Were disappearing. Yeah, that's
they
right.
They got poisoned later, so I don't think they were able to pass on their genes to have another generation.
I guess it's just my Freddy Krueger obsession poking through.
Hey, that's fine, man. It's all good. So then Augie starts hearing footsteps in his house, and he hears a ghostly voice. The lights flicker off and he hides and sees a ghostly specter asking, "Who took my toe?" And then he gets dragged under the bed and he's gone. Or is Bye. That the yeah. yeah, he got dragged under the bed. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, like he hides under the bed and then he starts to mm-hmm. like finally, you know, get out from under it after he thinks he's safe, but he is not.
Mm-mm. Nope. Mm-hmm. So then Stella and Ramon get to Augie's house, but he is gone. And then Stella tells Ramon that all of this is her fault because she took the book. So she puts the book in a trash bin and starts a fire. They knock the bin over and the book is still intact. Awesome.
So before
go ahead.
Before we dive farther, do we want to talk about, because with the big toe, the story in the book, it's mm-hmm. disembodied voice saying who took my toe, and that's all that we know. And in the movie, it looks like the corpse woman question mark from, I forget what the story is called, but the one that haunts all of our nightmares, isn't that the illustration of that one gal,
the one in the haunted house, I think mm-hmm. is that illustration
mm-hmm. the creepy woman,
yes, the haunted house. So mm-hmm. they kind of just like threw her into this story.
Yeah,
did we not like that?
Well, the illustration for the big toe wouldn't really fit, so I kind of loved it.
Yeah, of course I've got like a copy of my book. Yeah, because like the toe originally, it was like in the grass and he's got like his little hoe.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a picture of the kid, right? So like,
mm-hmm. right.
It's not the monster.
Yeah.
I liked it. I almost wish that we could have seen a little more of the creepy corpse woman, just because she was such a big part of my nightmares. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of looking at images now just to like check out how, not exactly how much screen time she had, but like we get like a tiny glimpse of her. We see like her feet as she's approaching and then like a tiny bit of her face, and that's kind of it. I wish we could have seen a little more.
Yeah.
Covering my eyes because I was so scared, and it's my problem.
Sorry. There she is.
Miss in all of her glory.
She's so spooky. I love her. Yeah.
I do think it was a good way to bring in, like, well, we need a monster for the big toe story, so let's bring in this monster that we don't want to tell her story right now, so let's just throw her in. That works.
Yeah.
I'll never look at stew the same way again.
Oh. And yet I still want some right now.
I know.
Yeah, right? It's definitely a stew day. Mm-hmm.
Definitely eat stew with a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Stew alone. Friends don't let friends eat stew alone.
Yes. That's good advice to live by.
That's a good Thank compromise. You. Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much.
Stew supervision. Have your stew buddy.
Oh, yes. So Stella and Ramon decide they need to learn more about Sarah Bellows. So they head to an archive at the newspaper. They find out that Sarah died in 1898, and then the rest of the family disappeared in 1899. And then it goes into, I don't know if it just mentions the Wendigo and the Red Spot, or it just like mentions it briefly.
Yeah, like you see the heading.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then we find out they didn't just leave. They both have stones, and then it goes into the Red Spot. And blood begins to appear on a shirt, and a spider bites Ruthie. The bite begins to swell on Ruthie's face backstage at her play, and then the kids run to school to find her in the bathroom. Something begins to pop out of the bite and move, and it's a bunch of spiders. No, thank you. Nope.
Hard pass.
Yep, I do not. And then Stella says Sarah was there as a shadowy figure, and she was controlling the whole thing. So now I'm wondering too, because like I do vaguely remember the shadow. Do you think like the big toe corpse thing? Oh no, because that wouldn't have been Sarah, right? Because I don't think they took.
No, it wouldn't have, because we see Sarah later, not to get ahead of ourselves.
That's mm-hmm. right. That's right.
And she had like albinism, and the corpse for the big toe one had dark hair.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So then the kids go to visit a woman named Lulu, and again, a music box is playing The Worms Crawl In, The Worms Crawl Out. Lulu tells them they'll be next, and she sings along with the music box. It's really creepy.
Creepy.
Mm-hmm. And then, they give her the book, and she says they shouldn't have taken it, which hard agree. and then... Lulu starts chanting The Worms Crawl In, and it's really creepy again. Like the creep vibes are high at this point. So then I feel like her caretaker came back into the room and was like, yeah, Lulu's had enough today, and the kids leave.
Yeah, like her daughter, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then the kids go to the hospital to get Sarah's records, which I was surprised like that they did that, because you can't do that. And that's what they find out, that they don't give out patient records. But when they tell the people on staff that they're working on a school report, they are like, okay, fill out a form. And you know, because they're older records, fill out the form. It might take a few weeks for it to clear.
They're like, it's okay, she's dead, nobody cares.
Yeah. It's like, no, I know. Yeah.
Very rude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so while like their backs are turned, the kids sneak into the Red Room, which gave me total like Jane Eyre vibes too, but also just like the Red Rum, Stephen King Shining kind of thing as well. Like, ugh.
I was thinking the part in the new It movie where he's in the library, that's kind of what that reminded me of.
Yeah. We find out Sarah was being tortured by her family through a voice recording. And then it goes into the story, The Dream. Yes.
My favorite part about that little scene was the one kid was afraid to go with them into the Red Room because it was like mm-hmm. they'd already started writing his story or something like that. And they're like, okay, you stay here. And he immediately just like leaps.
Right?
They're like, you stay here. And he like sits along this wall for about 10 seconds. And he's like, nah, I'm getting in the elevator and just going to wander.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense. Like, and if you're going to do that...
Hospital workers start like chasing him though, so that's why he started running away.
No, that was after he did that. Like
that was after.
Oh, he just dipped for no reason.
Yeah, he was like squeezed up against the wall, and a hospital person walks by and doesn't notice him, and then he's like, "All right, I'm going in the elevator." And then he goes up to the third floor, and he's on some kind of like catwalk thing between the buildings outside, and that's when the orderlies see him and start chasing him.
Funny too, because like up to this point, no one had been disappeared while there were other people around. And in fact, when they got to the sister, they were able to like not make sure she didn't disappear when they got there. So I don't know why he decided to, I'll let me be by myself right now. Like that was the stupidest thing.
Yeah.
And Jonathan were both like
horror movie logic at its finest.
It didn't make sense, because I feel like I also would have told the orderlies, like, hey, I thought I was leaving the building, and as it turns out, I'm somehow on the roof. Can you help me?
Yeah,
he's somehow on the roof.
I was visiting somebody, and I was trying to leave, but now I'm turned around. Please escort me out. But he was just like, no, I gotta go.
And I'm not talking to them either. And it's like, you know, granted, he wasn't in, like, a hospital gown or anything, but they might have thought he was like an escaped patient or something like that too. So
yeah, like he easily could have said, hey, I was visiting my grandma or whatever, and I'm leaving now, but I got turned around. Help me out.
Like, love that. So yeah, we're in. The story is the dream, and there's this super creepy specter coming down the red halls. And he's just like closing in, and everywhere he turns, she's there. And then the specter ends up like hugging him, but then pulls him inside of her body. I'm not here for it.
Nope.
Creepy.
Mm-hmm.
It was super creepy.
And very different from the book version, which I don't remember if that was book two or book three.
I thought the thing looked like the picture in the book. Like they did a really good job, but I don't remember that story.
Mm-hmm. It's almost exactly like the illustration. It's really well done. The story, this is another one where I haven't looked over it in a long time, but I'll try and remember it. It was called The Dream, and it was about a gal who, I think she has a nightmare that she's in this room, and this pale lady with dark hair and a creepy face says something like, "This is an evil place, flee while you still can." And so this person wakes up from that dream and decides to leave where she's currently living. So she goes to live in a new place, meets the tenant of this apartment or whatever, like the landlady. And the landlady takes her upstairs and says, well, this is our guest room and whatever. And she looks at the room and it looks really familiar to the room in her dream. So she's kind of freaked out. And the landlady says, well, I'll get a cup of tea and you just think about whether you want to take the room or not. So she goes downstairs and the gal is looking around the room and thinking it was just a stupid dream, whatever. It does look pretty similar, but it's probably nothing. And then she hears someone coming back up into the room and thinking that it's the landlady. She goes over there and it's actually the pale lady from her dream. And she says the same thing. This is an evil place. Flee while you can. And so the person in the story just runs past her and runs out of the house. And that's kind of the end of the story. And in the movie, the pale lady doesn't say anything. She just kind of slowly absorbs you. So it's an interesting take on the story.
Yeah. Could you imagine, like, you think you're going in for a hug with a nice, but maybe creepy looking like creature. And then you're just absorbed, like, you know, a gelatinous cube in D&D or whatever. Like, not cool.
Now we'll be together forever.
Best friends.
Oh, I was scared of you, but you just want to give me a hug. Nope.
Yeah, and kind of how you were describing the dream too, it made me think of Lulu from like our previous scene as well, just like how she was kind of prophetic and that sort of thing too. It's really interesting that this was the story that came right after that scene. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that specter like super creeped me out. No thank you.
Beady little eyes and just the wide weird smile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
no thanks. So the kids come running to find their friend, and of course they get caught by the employees. So they get taken to the police station, and Stella ends up calling her dad to say if she goes missing, it is not his fault. Obviously she can't say what's actually going on because, you know, she'd end up in an asylum as well. So she's there with Ramon, and she stays in jail with him, and they find out that Ramon is a Vietnam draft dodger. And the reason he is a draft dodger is because his brother died there, and he just didn't want to go because they just send you there to die. And that's an exact quote from the book, and it's heartbreaking as well. Like, it's just so sad, and the fact that he's getting so much flack for it too, which I know was a very real thing. It's just, it's really hard. So they find out that Ruth has been sent to an asylum, and I feel like too, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but I feel like sending her to an asylum was just something, because I know people saw like the spiders coming out of her face, so it's like, shouldn't you send her to the ER?
Yeah, she's crazy. She thinks spiders came out of her face. Well, they did.
And people saw it.
And there were like lots of witnesses.
Yeah.
And there's a big scar on the front of her face.
Right.
But it's fine.
It doesn't make any sense to me, because I could see like she's going to be in isolation or something until further notice, but not like, she's going to be in the asylum forever.
I mean, I guess she could be losing her mind because a bunch of spiders just came out of her flipping face. Right. So maybe she was like hysterical. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think she was just in like enormous shock for a while. Cause remember when they found her, she like wasn't talking. She was all freaked out. It's like Kelsey said, like, it's understandable. Maybe check back in a few weeks. And then if she's still not cool, we could, get her some extra help, but just let's give her a second.
Right. Absolutely. So then while they're sitting there and Ramon and Stella are chatting, the cop ends up looking at the book, and he sees that the ink smears when he touches it and the lights flicker off. They begin to hear spooky sounds, and then a dog randomly appears in the station.
Whose dog is this?
I was so confused though, because the cop knew the dog, but it was like not there because he's like, hey, trigger, what's up?
I think it's supposed to be like a police canine situation.
But it was very confusing because all of us, you're right, it does seem like it just kind of appears out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, how did you get in here? Usually police stations are pretty secure. You can't just like go wandering off toward the cells and whatnot. So
the dog just like came running around the corner and was like, I also work here.
He hopped off a train at LAX with his dream and a cardigan.
Yeah, sure did.
Yep. And as we discover, it is the Mitai Doty Walker.
This was my favorite one.
I agree. What did you think?
Tell me more.
Yeah.
What did I think? I wasn't just like, I really liked the creature apart from the book, like as a separate thing from the book. I just, the second that I think it says the title of the story, you see it on the notebook, right? So the second I see that, I'm like, okay, the station dog is going to go over to the chimney and we're going to hear a disembodied voice calling outside, and it's going to be really creepy. And then the policeman is going to turn and watch the dog say it back, and it's going to be really creepy, and we're going to hear it again from right out of the chimney, and then the head is going to come rolling, like just like the book. And I was expect, because that story is so creepy, that if I would have taken that and made it and like popped it right into the movie like that, I just think it would have been so good. But instead, it's just like a head comes out and like says the words in a threatening way, not like in a sad sing-songy way like it is in the books, like not in a haunting way. He's just like, and then like a bunch of other body parts fall. Like it just like, I almost wish that they would have tried to tie that to a different creature, like a different.
I agree with that, because they kind of mixed it with the other story that I don't remember the name of it, but where it's like the lonely lady who's just like, I just wish someone was here. And then a pair of feet fall, and then the legs, and then the body, and then so they kind of like made a weird kind of amalgamation of the two stories. So I do agree with that. But just the creature itself, I thought was like coolest one. And then it starts like spider walking all over the place. Ooh, after the limbs all assemble.
That was a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I think that was the spookiest creature to me. I don't know if it was that creature that was the spookiest or the one from the dream, but both of them totally freaked me out. I think this one too, because you like watch the body parts or whatever, like come together and he was crawling around. So I'm with you, Eric. I thought it was super, super creepy.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you in that separate from the book, I really liked the creature. I thought he was really freaky and awesome. I guess this was the one where I was the most disappointed with how they tied it in. But you know what? It's kind of okay because this creature is amazing.
Yeah, I do agree with you though. Like, they shouldn't have done that part of it. They should have just had it been the body fall down and not done the whatever the gibberish word, the creepy word was. Because that is really the only part from that story was just using that word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyways, here comes this guy. In the movie, they call him, I think, the Jangly Man.
Is that what they call him?
I think so. It's really creepy. I don't like that.
Yeah. I didn't write down the name, but I know Ramon and Stella, they're both trying to convince the police officer to let them out of the cell, which is super fair. And then Ramon is saying, like, this is my story. It's a story that totally scared him, you know, as a kid. And then, of course, the skull says, "Me tie Doty Walker." And that is horrifying.
And just like snaps the cop's neck. That cop is not gone. He is dead. Mm-hmm. There is no recovering that policeman.
Yeah.
And I did think it was funny that the creature squeezes through the cell and was yelling, "Coward!" at Ramon.
Yeah.
Because of course it's he was like running from the draft too, but also the creature.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting now that you point that out, that the cop who was an adult was pretty clearly killed. Mm-hmm. The kids are being taken, if you will.
Yeah.
Like with the big toe, the corpse that finds Augie, like drags him away. He doesn't really die. He's just gone, like he's missing. Like,
well, the kids from Sarah Bellow's time, they disappeared too, right? They weren't just like, mm-hmm. I think it was implied that they died of mercury poisoning later. And maybe the family was, I don't know.
I'm confused. That, like, I wonder if whatever it is that is like all these monsters that are coming into this world are, they don't care about the adults and about like hearing them or taking them. Just it's only the kids, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it would make sense, like maybe she wants to torture them a little bit because they were kind of like torturing her. I don't know,
that's a bummer.
Yeah. Revenge.
So many questions we need answered with the sequel.
I know.
Yeah, man. Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. You guys, if there's a sequel, we're having a sequel party.
Absolutely. Yes. So Ramon grabs the keys from our now deceased police officer and he frees them from the cell. And then he tells Stella to run and talk to Sarah so she'll stop doing this. Smart. So the creature jumps on Ramon's stolen cop car because he stole the police car to like make a quick getaway. And then Stella makes it to the house, tells Sarah to stop. And we start hearing once more, the worms crawl in, the worms crawl out. Mm-hmm. And it folds into a story, the haunted house. So this was Stella's story. So Ramon finds the book and tries to find Stella. Stella's in the house, but when it was still in its glory days, so it's still like super fancy and swanky. In this story, she is Sarah, and Sarah's family is looking for her. A blind relative shouts that she's in the room with her.
And that is the woman from the beginning of the movie who was sitting there with the dog and looked at the wardrobe. That's the same woman.
Okay. Oh. So it's like foreshadowing, essentially.
Yeah. And I got major, I know this is obviously before Stranger Things season four, but that part reminded me of Stranger Things season four when they have a flashback to that house with Victor Creel. Just a little side note.
Yes, totally. Totally. So there's like a house girl like that works in the house, and she helps her hide, gets caught, and they grab her because she was telling everyone that there was something wrong with the water. And by she gets grabbed, I mean Sarah gets grabbed. The house girl gets in trouble, but Sarah gets grabbed.
The house girl, I think, was the girl with the or maybe that girl's mom that they went to see earlier with the music box.
That makes all the sense.
Oh. We're smart.
Eric, you just blew my mind.
I know.
Yeah, so they take Sarah / Stella to a locked barren room and threaten to take her to the asylum. They turn off the light, leaving her in total darkness. She finds the book, hears a raspy voice, and sees Sarah, who says she has another story.
Just for you.
No more stories, Sarah. Jeez, leave these kids alone. So Ramon's voice says, tell her the truth. And Stella says, while Sarah was a victim, she turned into a monster. Stella says she'll tell Sarah's story, but her rage has to stop and all of this just has to end. Sarah hands Stella an old pen and tells her to use her blood to write Sarah's story. So it's kind of like a blood oath kind of thing too. Like, okay, if I stop doing this, we're literally going to use your blood to do thing. And then Sarah releases them from the spell. So that also, going back to like the 1968 thing. So maybe it was just, she wrote this book in 1968 and then it was published later on. So yeah.
Tell ourselves that to fill in the plot holes.
Because there's got to be something.
There's got to be a reason they said it in 1968 besides like the weird draft dodgy scene stuff.
Maybe 1968 was just such a vibe that they couldn't resist. I do like what I think one of you said earlier, though, about tying into the nostalgia of that time. Maybe like, you know, the walkie-talkies and like the handmade costumes and things like that. Maybe it was supposed to be some kind of tie to like, yes, like most of these readers weren't kids at that time, but it just has a nostalgic Halloween-y, homey feel to it. Maybe they were trying to tie into that aesthetic.
And maybe they were trying to avoid, because we immediately made a Stranger Things comparison. Maybe they were trying to avoid, like, if they said it in the 80s when the book came out, maybe they were worried about, like, people just being like, oh, it's a Stranger Things ripoff or something. I don't know.
Yeah, interesting.
Maybe we'll find out in, like, a sequel. So then, like, you know, the story is beginning to wrap, and one of the, like, overture things is stories hurt, stories heal. If we repeat them enough, they become real. They have that power, which I thought was really interesting, too, and a good way to, like, wrap up the movie. And then Stella did tell Sarah's story, and we see Ramon getting on the bus to go to war because he decided he's going to go. And then we close with Stella being sure she can bring Chuck and Augie back with the book.
And it's her and her dad and what's the other guy's name? Not Augie, the other one's sister in the backseat as they're driving somewhere. And my own personal theory is that they are on the run from the law because... How else did that cop die? Like, no one's going to believe that this creepy story came to life. They are definitely still in trouble and on the run.
100%. And they must have broken, like, Ruthie out of the asylum, too, to, like, take her with them wherever they're going.
Uh-oh.
I know, right? There's, like, so much going on.
Sequel. Like, sequel.
there's 100% going to be a sequel, I think. I feel like it's going to be a trilogy because weren't there three books total?
I mean, they do pull from stories from all three books in this first movie, but I wouldn't be mad if they made three movies.
So cool. Be so cool. All right, so there was also some old tech, again, that I hadn't mentioned, and one was a gramophone. So I feel like that sets it a bit more like into the 60s. And then the other one was just a really, really, really old TV. So that kind of puts it a bit more in the time and place.
The wax cylinder, even instead of like a record or a tape cassette of the, yeah.
Yeah. So... yeah, I am curious about like why it was set in the 60s. Like, cause I mean, they could have set it at any time or they could have set it at like no time. So I don't know.
It's not like I think cell phones would have really, cause that's kind of why I think a lot of times you'll set something these days, you know, pre-cell phone, because cell phones ruin everything. And like, you know, but I don't feel like cell phones would have helped them solve any of the problems that they had with these supernatural creatures.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So did you have a favorite part? Because I feel like Eric might have kind of talked about his favorite thing too, or I guess like just a part that's the most memorable, because I feel like it's hard to pick a favorite part in a really like a scary movie. So what was your most memorable part?
Yeah, I liked the creature that was spider walking everywhere. I can never remember the Doughty, whatever weird word that was. Mm-hmm. And I also really did like the scarecrow in the cornfield.
Yeah.
I thought those were both very well done.
Yeah. I think mine is Harold, just because the story creeped me out so much when I read the book. Mm-hmm. Knowing that he was going to be in the movie just really freaked me out. I don't think his movements were particularly creepy. He just kind of disappeared and then reappeared somewhere else. And I don't know, man, there's something to it though. When you're in the dark in a cornfield and it's quiet and there's movement where there should not be movement. Oh, I don't like it. I think really got me a lot. But also, there's something to be said for the corpse lady from Big Toe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she was creepy.
And I wish that we'd gotten a little more of her.
It was really just kind of a jump scare.
Yeah, and I wish that we could have really like sat in that for a minute and seen how horrifically creepy she is, because they did a good job and I would have loved to see a little more of that. I think that I just missed it because I was like covering my face in fear. I don't think I missed it. Maybe I did and now I'm complaining, but I actually was just physically covering my eyes.
It was definitely like a pretty brief flash, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's something to be said for her too, because she's a little bit less memorable because we see so much less of her, but that was a real creepy moment too.
Well, maybe in the sequel when they're getting Augie.
Speaking of which, I don't want to like bulldoze over Heather talking about her favorite part. I want you to do that, but
bulldoze.
It sounds like there is going to be a sequel of the
Yay.
But I don't think there's much known about it yet, but I guess they renewed it around 2020.
Ooh, that's cool. So
anyways, if that gets you all excited, we'll see if it actually comes to something.
I hope it does, because we have a lot of questions. So I hope that we get a sequel.
Fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, and my favorite part. I totally forgot about that. So my favorite, I think, was honestly... it's not my favorite, but the most memorable parts for me were the spiders coming out of the face. That was
terrifying.
And definitely him being kind of like enveloped by that spooky specter as it was like coming closer and closer. I was just like envisioning myself in that scenario. Like, but those were the two parts where it was like shocking to me. Like, what? Because like with the thing on her face, I knew something bad was going to happen. And then when it happened, I was like, ooh. Ooh, I'm gonna throw up everywhere.
Yeah, that was tough.
Yes. All right, so on a scale Well, what was our scale we used the other day, Shelby? A scale of bloody fingers on your hands. How many bloody fingers would you give this movie?
I would give it 3 bloody fingers and a knuckle. 3.5 bloody fingers.
I think something similar. Maybe a solid. Maybe like 3 bloody fingers and then like up to the second knuckle. Like,
yeah.
4. Because I really, really enjoyed it. I have a few tiny complaints that I have detailed over the last hour and a half. But overall was super great and super fun. And I really enjoyed it. So 3 bloody fingers and up to the second knuckle.
What I will say is that, like, when I watched it a year or two ago, having not read the book in decades and decades, I thought it was much worse. But now that I like recently reread most of the stories, it made me appreciate the movie more. Even though the stories weren't like true to the book, I think just like looking at the artwork in the books and, you know, having a firmer grasp of what things look like and how phenomenal a job they did of making those like still images come to life in the film, I thought was really great.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was originally going to go with 3 very bloody fingers, but once I learned more about like Harold and that, it totally upped it for me too. So I think I'm hovering between 3 fingers and a knuckle and 3 fingers and a second knuckle. So we've got a 3.5, a 3.6, and a 3.75.
There you go.
Perfect. All right, is there anything else that we must talk about?
Read the book. It's on shelves here at the library. Watch the movie. It's on our shelves here at the library. Your local librarians are happy to help you find them. Mm-hmm. Bask in the creepiness with us.
Yes. And I definitely recommend reading the book first because you will be so excited when you see one of the stories that you recognize show up on the screen.
Yeah. Yeah. And Kelsey was right. It's always interesting to me, these anthologies, how they're going to tie everything together. And I thought they did a good job. Mm-hmm. I might have preferred this as a TV show where, mm-hmm. you know, like every 30 minute or maybe even an hour episode would be each story, I think could be really cool, but I think they did a very fine job with choosing to do it as a movie.
Yeah, it could have totally had like a supernatural episodic vibe, like where they would do like a spooky specter in the first couple of seasons. That would have been awesome.
Yeah, or like what was that show, Are You Afraid of the Dark, where it was kids taking turns telling scary stories. Like, yeah. They could have had each episode be one of these stories that a kid was telling, or the new Midnight Club on Netflix, which is like the Christopher Pike thing. Like, that could have been a cool setup, but I think for what they chose to do as a movie, like, they did a really good job of finding a way to like make these stories kind of, you know, fit in together.
I mean, we've also been going on about this for an hour and a half, so we've shared, well, and in addition to like the 5 hours that we talked about the book. So yeah,
a lot of content creation going on.
So much content creation. So I don't think I have anything to add other than we definitely hope that you check these out, check both of them out, because they are super spooky and just really perfect for October. So this wraps up our 2022 Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark podcast series. For real this time, we really are wrapping it up. So until next time, stay spooky. Bye.
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 Make yourself a big bowl of stew and then read the big toe and, you know, watch the movie.